Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, Episode 17, The Audiophile Perspective. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by Audible.com. To download a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/theater. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here with UltimateAVMag.com and HomeTheaterMag.com. This week's guest geek of the week is John Atkinson, editor of Stereophile magazine, recording engineer, musician, and a colleague of mine at the same company that publishes my websites. Hey, John, look, how you doing? Welcome to the show.
Yeah, just getting a plug in for the mothership there, Scott.
Excellent, excellent. It is the mothership. That magazine's been in publication for, what, 30 plus years?
Since 1962.
Holy smokes.
I didn't join until 86, so I'm a newcomer.
Founded by J. Gordon Holt, right?
Yes, yes. A legendary old school engineer stroke journalist.
Uh-huh.
He founded it in 62, and I think he put out, 40 issues between then and 1982 when he sold it to a businessman, and then I bought into the company in 86. And right. Gordon stayed with us right through till 1999. He was a force of nature, no doubt about it.
Yeah, no doubt about that. No doubt about that. And well known in the audiophile community. Well, yeah, I'm really happy.
Sorry,
go right ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, Gordon sort of formulated so much of what drives high-end audio today, a vocabulary for describing listening, an ethos, a journalistic ethos about, you know, saying what you feel no matter whose feathers get ruffled. Mm. He was an icon. He passed away last summer.
Yes, I was very sad to hear that. And in his later life, I think he did start embracing video. He had a projector, didn't he? He had some sort of home theater?
Yes. Well, yes, he actually, the very first home theater issue of Stereophile, I think, was August 1964. And he got a reel-to-reel Ampex video recorder he was playing with. And was sort of, he prophesied then that home theater would become big. Of course, he was 30 years before his time.
Typical.
Yeah. But I mean, when we launched Stereophile Guide to Home Theater magazine in 1990, the end of 94, and that then morphed into UltimateAVMag.com, Gordon was a major contributor all through the first 5 years of its existence. Mm-hmm. And I mean, he was the first person I ever knew having a video projector. He had an Advent. Was it Advent?
I think that was certainly one of the earliest ones.
Yeah, the Henry Close projector. I think I remember visiting him in 1985 and just being knocked out by the quality you can get from NTSC.
Of course, now we'd look at that and go, I think we can do a little better.
Indeed.
Well, listen, I've got so many things I want to talk to you about. I doubt we're going to get through them all. So even before we finish, I want to say I hope you'll come back.
Sure.
Now, in addition to being the editor of Stereophile, you are a recording engineer and a musician. Following closely my own path of interests, I've been a musician and recording engineer much longer than I've actually been a journalist. So, and I think the same is true of you, is it not?
Yes. I mean, for me, being an audiophile and being a musician and being a recording engineer all go together. My mother bought me a mono Grundig tape recorder for my, 16th birthday. Mm. And I started playing in bands around the same time, playing bass guitar. And I made the recordings of the band. And, of course, I wanted to hear those with as great good a quality as possible. So I got my first audio system. We didn't call it high-end back then. In 1968, my first real system, a pair of Wharfdale speakers, a Kenwood amplifier, and a Garrard turntable and Shure cartridge, and rapidly upgraded the turntable to a Thorens, belt drive Thorens. Mm-hmm. Got an SME arm, and so basically the three things went together: the recording, the being a musician, and being an audiophile. My training, my education is all in science. I followed my parents' wishes. After getting my bachelor's degree, I went into scientific research, working in various labs. Every time I see a green LED, I get a twinge of nostalgia, because I worked in a lab in England, which was, we developed a green LED for the first time in England. And
no kidding.
I'm probably the only audio magazine editor who's ever grown his own transistors from scratch by actually starting with a silicon crystal and then depositing different dopings and different silicon layers on it in what's called an epitaxial bath, where you have, you know, you're basically depositing silicon from vapor. And I used to make my own transistors at the lab.
So that's incredible.
Yeah, and then 72, I'd always been playing bass guitar on the side at the lab. And then in 1972, I got an opportunity to go professional with a band, and then did that for 5 years. Did a lot of broadcasts, a lot of recording, a lot of touring. And then that all sort of fell apart. Being a musician is very much a network thing. And the oil crisis in the mid-70s, sort of the producer I was doing most of my work for went bust. The studios I was on call for as the session bass player, they went bust pretty much. So my then wife at that time said, hey, this magazine in England, Hi-Fi News, is advertising for an editorial assistant. You know, you read that magazine, you've got a hi-fi, why don't you apply for it? So I did and got it, and here I am now.
Basically. Oh my God, wow. Well, this...
I kept playing for a couple of years, but I had to make the choice between being a musician and being a journalist in around 1978, and really I fell in love with magazine publishing.
Mm. Well, this brings up really the first topic that I wanted to cover with you, particularly because we share this. When I was working at my previous employer, we were sitting around before Cedia started, and a bunch of audiophiles said to me, do you consider yourself an audiophile? And I said, well, not really. We talked about it a little bit more, and they came to decide, once they learned that I was a professional musician, that, oh, well, no wonder you're not an audiophile. You experience live music so much that no amount of money spent on a reproduction system can possibly match that experience. And I had to think, wow, that's actually pretty logical. And yet what you're saying is kind of the opposite, that for you anyway, they went together so well that you have embodied them or incorporated them all into your life as it is now.
Well, I mean, a lot of people say that, you know, musicians don't have good hi-fi systems. With some, it's true. With a lot, it's not. I mean, there are a lot of musicians among my friends who have great hi-fi systems. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, if you say take a famous, you know, some famous conductor like, Lauren Mazel, he can hear the music in his head from reading a score. He doesn't need a system at all. And, all the rest of us need some kind of help. And as I said, for me, I knew what I was recording. I wanted to hear what we did with as best quality as possible. I mean, I coincidentally was at an audiophile's place on Saturday, and a friend came in. He'd got hold of an album I was on that I'd recorded with my band in 1977. And without telling me, he put it on the system, and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, I remember, you know, I remembered all the efforts we had put in the mix, all the little effects we had done, all the little clever bits in the stereo positioning. And my goodness, on this system I was listening to Saturday night, you could hear it all. It was like, it was worth the effort we put into it. I don't know. You wouldn't have heard that on a boombox, but certainly on the good system, you know, everything we had done was there, laid bare, to be enjoyed.
Well, I have to admit, I did have a similar experience very recently. I've been reviewing the Stax SR007 electrostatic headphones.
Great cans.
And expensive. You have to have one of those. You have to have one of those driver units to drive it and to accept the signal from your stereo system. And together, the driver unit and the ear speakers, as they call them, you know, are around $4,000.
Yeah.
But I was listening to a couple of albums that I recorded, and man, I wish I'd had those when I was actually doing the mixdowns, because you're exactly right. It revealed so much of the inner workings of what was going on that I found myself, as I was listening just last week, you know, wow, I wish I'd had these in the studio.
Well, I mean, to some extent, good hi-fi is like wine, you know. I mean, I don't have a great palate. On the other hand, I'm sure if I'd now bought a bottle of the wines I was enjoying 30 years ago, I'd go, oh my goodness, how could I ever have enjoyed these? You know, your palate develops. And once you hear something that's good, it's very hard to go back to less good. Of course, you know, you don't have to pay $4,000 for the Stax SR007s. You can get really good, you know, moving coil headphones for, you know, $400 to $500. They're not quite as revealing, but they are still, you know, musical, still in detailed.
You know, this whole question. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, you don't have to spend a fortune.
Right, right. This whole conversation reminded me of an article you wrote. I don't remember exactly when it was, describing an experiment that you did where you had a piano concert, right? Recital.
Yes.
And you set up some very nice microphones and used very nice recording equipment. And the piano player played the recital with an audience sitting there listening to it. You recorded the recital and then immediately played it back for the same audience.
Yes, that was. I wrote about it in the February issue of Stereophile.
Oh, so very recently, more recently than I recall.
It was in a private house in Maryland. Well, it was the living room was like 35 feet long with 20 foot ceilings, and so it was a big room. And they
nice private house.
And the pianist was a Steinway musician, so Steinway, you know, gave us a 9-foot Steinway D for free, and all we had to pay for was basically the transport and the tuning. And the idea, I mean, basically it was sponsored by a group of audio manufacturers who wanted to show off what their components could do, and I thought it would be fun to take part. The big problem with those kind of demonstrations is if you record the piano as though you were doing it for a record, you try to capture some of the ambience of the room. And if you play back that recording in the same room, now you're getting the room acoustic twice. And it'll always sound very different. So I actually put the microphones closer than I would have done if I were making a recording. Made a rather dry-sounding recording. And then when you play that back in the same room, you have a chance of it, you know, being close to the live sound. Surprisingly, as I say in the February issue, the speakers and the amps and everything got the tonal quality right. They got the dynamics right. They just get the size of the instrument. Now, I'm using a mic technique which accurately captures stereo imaging. Nevertheless, the image of the piano was smaller and less enormous than the real thing. Of course, the real thing is 9 foot long.
Right.
And that was really instructive.
Yeah, absolutely. What was the miking technique you were using?
Well, I used what's called an ORTF pair of cardioids. That's a pair of cardioids spaced, you know, close like that, about capsules about 11 inches apart, 7 inches apart.
Facing at an angle away from each other.
Yes. And then you basically get a reasonably good stereo image. I then used a pair of Outrigger Omnis, which, trouble with cardioid mics, which you use in that cross-pair configuration, they never capture the low frequencies with sufficient weight. So I used a pair of Omni mics spaced around 5 feet apart, one each side of the central pair, and that captures the bass and the kind of the power of the instrument. And then I did on the fly a mix of the two pairs of mics to try to get the best of both worlds. The Omnis giving me the bass, the power, and the cross cardioids giving me the stereo imaging and the treble detail. And it worked quite well.
Of course, you had to do that mix on the fly because you were going to play this back right away.
Yes,
and you didn't want the audience to have to wait.
That's right. I was recording on my laptop and playing back through very high quality D2A converters from Esoteric. I was recording everything with 24 bits resolution, 96 kilohertz sampling. So it was, you know, the best possible resolution I could get. Mm-hmm. But as I said, it still didn't get the immenseness of the piano. And I mean, I wrote about this in February, but I mean, one thing that's different is loudspeakers. You know, if you take a piano or a violin or a flute, it radiates sound into the room in a very specific way. It doesn't radiate sound equally in all directions. And a loudspeaker, you know, if you only ever played violin recordings, then maybe you should have a loudspeaker shaped like a violin because it will radiate sound into the room in just the same way that a violin does. However, you know, people want to play more than just one kind of instrument on their hi-fis. So you need a loudspeaker which has uniform radiation pattern, is equally wrong in a sense for everything. Mm-hmm. So a loudspeaker will never excite the room in the same way that a real instrument will. And that, I think, is one reason the live versus recorded in the end failed. I mean, it failed magnificently, but it failed.
Still sounded great, but you could in fact hear the difference.
Oh yes, yes. I mean, it was very enjoyable. I mean, the other thing is that the loudspeaker gets the intensity wrong. The intensity is the sound pressure level per unit area. So a piano has a very large radiating area, so the intensity is low for a given sound pressure level.
Sure.
In other words, each little bit of a piano soundboard is only radiating a little bit of sound. But the total is enormous. A loudspeaker will be wrong. Will get the intensity much, but it'll be much too large. So I'm beginning to think that that's something which, you know, you never bother about thinking about intensity when you're recording because there's no way you can address it. Nevertheless, mm-hmm. I think even if everything else were right, that still would be the major sort of obstacle to making live recorded sound like live.
Mm-hmm. What about different speaker configurations? Tannoy, for example, is famous for its coincident drivers. And then there are electrostatics, which have very large radiating areas.
Well, yes. I mean, I think this is one reason why people like electrostatics and magnaplaners, which are similar to electrostatics. They use a large panel just driven magnetically instead of electrostatically, is mm-hmm. they get an intensity which is closer to that of large instruments. Of course, the intensity is wrong for the flute and wrong for the human voice. So, I mean, with loudspeakers, you know, it's always a compromise. You can't get, you know, you basically, as I said, you have to get a loud, in trying to design a loudspeaker, you try to compromise between all the things it could do, between what is possible to do. And ideally, it will be equally wrong, but not very wrong on everything.
Kind of reminds me of equal temperament in a way.
That's a great analogy because, I mean, if you've ever heard a Pythagorean temperament recording, my goodness, it's sweet. All the fifths and thirds just are so sugar sweet. And when you go back to equal temperament, which is, you know, what all modern music is recorded in, it sounds out of tune.
Yes. Of course, if you had a harpsichord, say, tuned in Pythagorean to a particular key and you play in that key, as you say, the thirds and fifths and everything sounds sweet and wonderful. And then you move to the key of B, say.
Oh, it'd be horrible. The minute you play an accidental, it'll be terribly out of tune. So,
yes.
I mean, Wendy Carlos did a CD about 15 years ago where she did some demonstrations of equal temperament and Pythagorean temperament and modern temperament.
And some of her own temperaments as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
She had like three different scales that she used.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's very, very, what instrument do you play, Scott?
I play mostly the low brasses, in particular trombone. And one reason I really like the trombone is that the pitch is completely continuous. You have the slide, right? And it moves back and forth. And you can change the pitch by tiny, tiny amounts so that a G sharp in the key of E is actually different than an A flat in the key of D flat, say.
Yeah, I mean, my first instrument was violin. I played violin all through my teenage years. Great way to meet girls if you're not a jock. And I mean, yes, when you're playing the violin, you're always pulling into Pythagorean temperament all the time. You know, so when yes. you're playing, you know, as you said, a G sharp in the key of E, you're going to play a Pythagorean G sharp,
right.
unless you're playing with a piano, in which case all bets are off.
Exactly. Exactly. All the fretless strings have that same problem. Do you play fretless bass?
I do play fretless bass. Whenever I do a gig, I take both fretted and fretless with me. And if I can hear myself really well on stage, I will mm-hmm. play the fretless. But if I can't hear myself very well, you know, it's hopeless. Like I play out of tune in any key you want.
So equally well.
Yes. So yeah, if you're going to play a fretless instrument, you really have to be sure that you can hear yourself.
Yes. And everybody else.
And everybody else. I mean, that's the key to great musicianship is listening as much as playing.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly right. What are your thoughts regarding two-channel versus multi-channel music? We've seen, of course, DVD audio and SACD try to make a case for multi-channel music. And I've heard plenty of great examples in the early days, maybe not so many, mm-hmm. but later as engineers got to understand multi-channel music. But both of those formats kind of went by the wayside once we had MP3 and iPods and stuff. But just the basic theoretical question of two-channel, which is really more the realm of audiophiles, I think. Certainly your magazine yeah. focuses on two-channel versus multi-channel.
Yeah, there's a number of things going on here. I mean, I've heard some absolutely fantastic surround sound recordings from SACD and DVD-A. And also from computer files.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is that audiophiles worldwide are really interested in two channels. We do have a column on surround sound, called Music in the Round, written by Kalman Rubinson.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that 20% of my readers are passionate about surround, listening to music in surround. But it is only 20%. The other 80% want to stay with two channel.
Why do you suppose that is?
Well, I think first is that, you know, looking at it from my recording background, to make two channel recordings, there is a completely understood paradigm of what the engineer, producer, and mixer are trying to do. You're creating a rectangular window, as it were, between the loudspeakers with the, and you're looking through that window at a stage. Whether it's a reproduction of a live event, like a classical recording, or whether it's something which never existed, like a rock recording, nevertheless, that paradigm is, people don't even think about it. It is so natural. Mm-hmm. With surround, the paradigm isn't there. It's, well, what do I do? Do I recreate the space, which some companies are doing with great success, like Pentatone or Channel Classics in Europe? However, that's not very impressive unless you're attuned to it. In other words, when you set it up, and you feel yourself immersed in the concert hall because all the music is coming from you, but all the reverberation is coming from around you. That can be very convincing. Now, if you are looking for that, but with of course, classical music only being, 4% of the total, most non-classical surround recordings, to me, are, there's no paradigm they're following. I mean, I remember talking to I think it was Elliot Shiner who was remixing some Van Morrison for surround release on DVD-A. And mm-hmm. he said, well, I thought it'd be great. I could put the drums in the rear channels. I thought that'd be really cool. No one ever does that. Well, of course not. They don't do it because that's not how you listen to rock music.
Mm.
And so you got, I mean, you must have remembered the debacle of quadrophony in the 70s.
I lived through.
I set up my four speakers. And again, you've got all these recordings where you're in the middle of the orchestra, you're in the middle of the band, and mm-hmm. it's unnatural. It's sort of, when you hear, you know, loud sounds like drums or trombones coming from behind you, your flight reflex kicks in. You want to look over, what the heck is that? So
yeah.
So I think for classical, surround sound recording can be wonderful. For non-classical, I think it's still finding its way. And then I have to say that even though I think I have heard some wonderful classical recordings in surround, I don't have a surround system myself. Mm. I have to, given, you know, how I allocate the resources for my system, I go for the highest quality two-channel I can, rather than having less quality on the speakers and amps and source in order to get surround. And that's, I think a lot of people are going, they feel like I do. I made a point in a talk I gave a couple of years ago at an AES convention about this very, very same subject, which is, you know, surround sound is aimed at people. It is perfect for people who don't care about sound quality. Because, you know, think about all the home theater systems there are now in the world. I mean, it's the dominant sort of way of experiencing movies is at home in surround. Those people aren't really interested in music in surround without a picture. Now, the people who are concerned with sound quality, 80% of them have decided to stick with two-channel. So high-quality surround on SACD and DVD-A sort of fell between the two stools. It didn't have a picture, so general home theater enthusiasts wasn't really going to go for it. And the people who love the music didn't care about the extra channels.
Well, you make a great point about the if you have a certain amount of money to spend and you're trying to choose between two-channel and 5.1 or 7.1, you're not going to get as high quality in the equipment if you go multi-channel, given if you have a limited budget.
Yeah, I mean, I looked in horror at the advent of the home theater in a box phenomenon at the beginning of this decade, where, you know, you got five terrible speakers and it wasn't a subwoofer, it was a sort of woofer.
Yes.
You know, all for $500 when you can actually get a really good pair of two-channel speakers for $500, which wouldn't be really compromised much. I mean, they wouldn't have a great bass and they wouldn't go that loud, but certainly, you know, within those dynamic bass limitations, they could be really good indeed. And, you know, you just cannot do five speakers and a subwoofer for that same money of any quality whatsoever. And then you have a problem with the center channel, which is, I mean, the best surround systems for music I have heard use five identical loudspeakers, including a tower speaker in the center. But of course, that's a complete no-no for home theater because it would hide the screen.
Well, the only exception to that would be if you had what's called an acoustically transparent projection screen and you put that speaker behind it. But then you might be compromising the sound from that center channel because it has to pass through the screen.
Yeah, and horizontal center channels, the sound is compromised anyway by the fact that you have mid-range units either side of a tweeter. This gives you severe comb fielding for anyone except the person sitting exactly in the center.
Right. This is another actual complaint I've heard from some audiophiles that while the sweet spot, if you will, of two-channel is fairly narrow, the sweet spot in a 5.1 system is even smaller. It's a point rather than a line, if you will.
Yes. And that's actually something on some of the best surround recordings. They really are one person surround recordings.
Well, but I've always had the notion or the image of an audiophile as being a single person sitting in his or her chair, mostly his, I think, and listening to music.
Yes, I think that's true. I mean, it's not always true. And actually, you reminded me of something, which is, you know, I said I went to this gathering on Saturday and we listened to music. And I think two-channel is robust in the sense that there we were all in this guy's listening room. And yes, he had his one chair, so he dragged in some other chairs. And we were all, you know, sitting on the floor, sitting in the chair, sitting to the side. And we were all getting a good musical experience. I don't think that would have happened in surround because there would really have only been room for two people intimately close in the sweet
spot.
So I think two-channel is robust in that sense. You know, it's great to sit in the sweet spot, but if you don't, it still can be pretty good.
Now, this brings up another question that I've actually always wanted to ask an audiophile, and so here's my opportunity. The concept of imaging from a two-channel system. You have two speakers, one on one side, one on the left, one on the right, And presumably you're sitting in the middle between them, forming perhaps roughly an equilateral triangle. And speaker reviews often talk about imaging, which is how, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, the ability to imagine or hear different instruments in different locations between the two speakers. And I've always wondered how they do that. I mean, we were talking earlier about how speakers have a relatively small radiating area, generally, except electrostatics. But even then, you've got this radiating area at one location. You've got another radiating area in the other location. How is it that one speaker can do a better job than another at faking the position of instruments between them?
Well, it is a fake. I mean, there was a brilliant British engineer, Alan Blumlein, who in a classic patent from 1931 explained exactly how this is done by feeding, you know, if you feed the same signal to two loudspeakers, one on the left, one on the right, you don't hear two loudspeakers. You hear a phantom image in between them. And it was a work of genius to recognize that how that could be done. It is a trick. And I mean, for example, you listen to an orchestral recording and you hear, you know, violins on the left and cellos on the right, and there, just to the right of center, set a little way back, is a clarinet. None of that is real. There is no clarinet. There is no violin. There are no cellos. All you have is varying pressure waves coming out of both the loudspeakers, and your brain is constructing that from the information reaching the ears. So it's an illusion. And there are things which can upset and destroy the illusion. One of them, of course, I specialize in measuring loudspeakers for Stereophile. I've measured 750 over the last 21 years.
Wow. And
one of the things which messes up that illusion are speaker resonances, are cabinet resonances, are cone resonances. And you can hear this very easily for yourself. You play what's called pink noise, and it's dual mono pink noise. It's the same signal in each channel. So you put it on. There's some examples on some of the Stereophile test CDs that I've produced. And you listen, and you should hear on perfect loudspeakers an infinitely narrow band of noise midway between the loudspeakers. And that's, you never hear that.
Because there's no such thing as a perfect loudspeaker.
No, and so if a loudspeaker has, say, a strong cabinet resonance in the middle of the mid-range, which many cheap speakers do, now, each loudspeaker is going to be bonging away like a xylophone at its own preferred frequencies. And you hear that the image at those frequencies in the sort of voice range is actually kind of smeared and wide. It's no longer narrow in the center. Same with a mid-range unit where the cone is breaking up around 2 or 3 kilohertz, which is called the presence region. You'll hear that the image, the noise, instead of being narrow, the presence region part of that noise splashes to the sides because it's now not correlated between the channels anymore, because each of the mid-range cones, left and right, is singing along on its own. So that's one of the things that can destroy the illusion. High distortion will do the same thing. And of course, if your speakers aren't perfectly matched in frequency response, then you'll hear that the pink noise image is maybe a little bit to the left, and the mid-range is all the way to the right in the treble. It's a very good diagnostic test for how well the speakers are matched and do they have any problems which are interfering with the stereo imaging.
So that's how one speaker can do a better job or a less well, do it more or less well, is basically how much are they detracting from the perfect ideal.
Yes, and then there are things I don't understand. I visited an audiophile 3 or 4 years ago, and he was very proud of his system, and he had a pair of speakers which I actually wanted to listen to. So I went down, and I listened to his system, and it did one thing extremely well. It went extraordinarily loud with very low distortion. It really was impressive in that respect. And so I put on one of my chamber music recordings, which I'm using purist mic techniques to capture the sound of the instruments in the concert hall with just the right amount of reverb, giving you the feeling that there is behind the loudspeakers a hall. And I put one of these on, and there was no hall at all. There was no reverberation. Huh. And I've been puzzled ever since about what is it that speakers and maybe amplifiers could do which could remove all the reverb that I'd so carefully engineered into the recording.
And you haven't come up with an answer yet, huh?
No. And I mean, there are mechanisms. Gordon Holt, I used to have discussions with Gordon about this because he was adamant that there were things that some speakers would do would make it sound like there was more reverb than you'd actually got on the recording. Particularly, he used to hate loudspeakers with what was called the smile equalization, which is where you have a dip in the mid treble, which makes it sound laid back and polite and everything a little more distant than it really was. And Gordon used to hate that. Mm. Unfortunately, it's a very common characteristic of high-end loudspeakers, because if it's polite and if it's a little bit laid back, people tend to feel comfortable with that kind of sound.
Mm-hmm. This brings up also the issue that I've dealt with quite a bit in terms of the difference between consumer loudspeakers, even expensive ones, and studio monitors, which are typically designed to be as accurate and uncolored as possible, whereas I've always tended to believe that consumer speakers were designed to be somewhat colored in order to make them sound more pleasing. Is that something you have experienced yourself?
It's in the ideal situation, both kind of loudspeakers would be identical. The studio monitors tend to be optimized for two things. One is going really loud, particularly for monitoring rock music. The mixing engineers, the mastering engineers want dynamic range from their loudspeakers, and they'll sacrifice absolute accuracy to get it. The other is a lot of monitors will have an exaggerated level in the mid-treble. They'll be the opposite of the smile equalization, because the engineers want to hear detail. They want to hear if they make a small adjustment to something, they want to be able to unambiguously hear what the effect is. So a lot of studio monitors have an exaggeration in that region.
Mm.
Classical, I've seen a lot of high-end audio speakers used for classical monitoring, B&W 801s, quad electrostatics of various kinds. I've seen used by Polygram as was when they were making classical recordings. EMI for years used B&W hi-fi speakers in Abbey Road speakers, in Abbey Road studios. So for classical monitoring. So in the end, both speakers should be the same, but in practice, they tend to be optimized for different things. It goes back to what I was saying earlier, where your loudspeaker needs to be, its design needs to be balanced so that it's not very wrong in any one area. And that balance will change according to the need you have.
Sure. Okay. Well, before we continue, I'd like to take a moment to thank our sponsor for this episode, Audible.com, which is a leading provider of audiobooks with more than 60,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, even periodicals. For listeners of Home Theater Geeks, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. One audiobook you might consider downloading is The Twilight Zone Companion by Mark Scott Zikri. Almost 17 hours of episode synopses with Rod Serling's opening narration, behind-the-scenes stories from cast and crew. I have the printed version of this book, and it's very, very good, so I can highly recommend it. To download this or any other audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/theater. That's audiblepodcast.com/theater. Okay, we're talking with John Atkinson, editor of Stereophile magazine and musician, recording engineer, bon vivant. the next question I wanted to ask you was, it's so funny, when I was thinking about what to talk with you about today, most of my talking points, to use that phrase, came out as verses, you know, this versus that, one thing versus another.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them was analog versus digital audio, which can include recording and playback. I mean, audiophiles have always held a torch for vinyl, if you will, and continue to. Vinyl, in fact, I think is even growing in popularity these days. versus CD, which was supposed to be, in fact, was touted as perfect sound forever. Do you remember that?
Oh, yes, indeed.
Do you agree?
Well, I'm probably going to upset equal numbers of analog and digital diehards here.
But good.
I mean,
good.
CD never was perfect sound. It was as good as you could get in the early 80s when the system was crystallized, as it were. And, you know, looking back on the converters and the digital circuitry we had at that time, it really wasn't working that well. What it did very well was it didn't have any of the problems that analog playback suffered from that LP playback suffered from. It had wonderful pitch stability. So anybody who collected piano recordings welcomed CD with open arms. It had, you know, very, you know, it didn't have the normal, you know, catalog of noises that LP playback suffers from.
You mean like rumble, snaps and pops and that kind of thing?
And rumble and flutter and hiss and all that stuff. So CD was extremely good at the things where analog was poor. However, it took a while, like with anything new, it takes a while for you to learn the sound of what it's doing wrong. And, you know, with hindsight, it really wasn't good enough. And so what's interesting, Bob Stewart of Meridian did a paper some years ago at an AES convention where he showed that actually LP playback is better than 16-bit CD quality digital in the region where the ear is most sensitive.
Which is actually the 2 to 3 to 4K region.
Yes, LP playback actually has more dynamic range than 16-bit digital at that point. It's equivalent to, if I remember correctly, 18 or 19-bit. However, what's interesting about analog playback, LP playback, is that where it's really bad, which is in the low bass and the top octave, 10 to 20 kilohertz, that's where the ear is least sensitive to the problems.
Mm-hmm.
In a sense, what you could say that if you plot human hearing sensitivity against frequency, you get what's called the Fletcher-Munson curve, or more recently, Robinson-Babson curve, which is a big V like that. So the ear is most sensitive 2 to 4 kilohertz. It's not sensitive at all at the frequency extremes, 20 hertz and 20 kilohertz. And with the RIAA equalization that is used to master LPs and then to play them back with the inverse equalization, the noise and distortion gets worse as your hearing gets less sensitive, but it gets better where your hearing is more sensitive. So in a sense, you could say LP playback tailors the problems to fit the human perception very nicely. That's why it tends to sound good. The problems with 16-bit digital and CD quality digital, you can get rid of by going to higher resolution, which now is the norm for most classical recording, all classical recording, and an increasing amount of non-classical. You can go to higher sample rates, 96 kilohertz instead of 44.1 kilohertz. Even 192 kilohertz is now routinely available in recording equipment. Mm-hmm. And that gets rid of all those problems. So I would say that the high-resolution digital you can get now is equivalent to perfect sound forever.
Mm. And yet you can't buy that except on SACD or DVD audio.
You can download files now. Increasing number of companies are offering high-resolution downloads. You can go to stereophile.com and see ads for these people. I'm not sure if you want me to mention.
Sure. Go right ahead. I know of 2L in Norway.
2L in Norway, Lynn Records in Scotland, HD Tracks here in the United States, all have increasing numbers of catalogs of high-resolution digital files.
Doesn't B&W run a music service now, too, with high-res?
Yeah, and Lynn Records also has Channel Classics available in high-res. So there's more and more becoming available, and all you need to play those is a computer with an appropriate sound card. And there's a lot of good stuff available for not much money. The other thing about LPs, and I think this is where people like what it does wrong, that satisfying plop as you put the stylus in the groove kind of sets up your expectations that something good is about to happen.
Mm.
And what I found is that like the Saturday evening, the get together I went to, we played mostly LPs, and there was something very intimate and familiar and inviting about the sound, where each LP automatically led to a new one from the associations the music had. You know, we're playing Sonny Rollins, and somebody said, oh, you know, if we're playing Sonny Rollins, then let me play some John Coltrane, and, you know, out would come another LP, you know, and then, well, how about some Miles Davis? Okay, well, you know, how about some Jimmy Cobb, who was the drummer on Kind of Blue? And so you get those associations sort of coming because the LP experience sort of creates your receptiveness to the music. I mean, I think I'm sounding a bit sort of mystical here, but nevertheless, I think it's a real effect that playing an LP, perhaps with the ritual, perhaps with the fact that you have a large sleeve with a lot of information, and makes it much more of a sort of experience, whereas just pressing play on an iPod just isn't the same.
When CD came out, I bemoaned the death of cover art. No question about that.
Yeah. I mean, I mean, don't get me wrong about iPods. I think the iPod was the best thing ever to happen to music when it was introduced. I mean, the interesting thing also is that it wasn't the first MP3 player. It just happened to be the best with the most inviting experience. You didn't have to be in touch with your inner geek to use an iPod. And I first began to realize that Apple was onto something, because I commute on the subway every day. I saw increasing number of women, this was back in 2003, using iPods. Mm. So, you know, anything which reaches women as a target audience before it reaches audiophiles, that must be a very well-designed user experience indeed.
Yeah.
So, I mean, more thanks to the iPod, more people are listening to more music more often than any time in history right now. The sad thing is that most of that music sounds bad because it's lossy compressed MP3s, which, you know, the MP3 looks at CD sound, which I've already kind of described as not being adequate for true high fidelity, as an unattainable goal.
Yes, that CD quality sound is sort of the holy grail of iPodness. You're not going to get better than that, and even that's not good enough. Do you yourself listen to lossily compressed music on the iPod?
I do. I mean, it's sort of courses for courses. Anything that I'm going to listen to seriously, I have stored in lossless compressed, Apple lossless, which gives you about a 2-to-1 reduction in file size with no loss of quality. Mm-hmm. New music that I'm trying out, yes, I'll check out compressed versions before I buy the CD and rip it to my drive. You know, so it's courses for courses, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
But what I don't do is, you know, anything for serious listening, I don't use the lossy compressed versions. Then I'll re-rip the stuff as lossless or even uncompressed completely just to get the full benefit.
Right. What is the audiophile perspective on music servers and using computers? I would think that there'd be a lot of noise, electrical and acoustic, from a computer, not from an iPod, of course. But, you know, you've got this computer with a power supply and all kinds of stuff going on, hard drives spinning. Is that something that's important to audiophiles or important to avoid?
Yes. One of the three areas of passion right now in audiophile land are headphones, which you mentioned earlier, vinyl, which we've discussed, and computer. Integrating a computer into your playback system is a true high-quality source. And, I mean, bless you, Steve Jobs, because one of the best tools you can get is the Apple Mac Mini. It's cheap. It can be a fast computer, and it's absolutely silent. So, you know, rather than wrestling with a Windows PC with its fans and its noise, you can just get a Mac Mini. Of course, I've now upset everyone who does use a Windows machine. And there are brands like Shuttle, which specialize in quiet computers with no fan, liquid-cooled processors so that they're quiet. Hard drives have got quieter over the years. I don't see it's a major problem anymore.
Mm.
And then there are many solutions where you have your computer located remotely, and you from Sonos or Logitech Squeezebox, or Logitech done the new Logitech Touch, where you have your computer in a separate room and you're sending the music data to your audio system via Wi-Fi or even Ethernet.
Mm-hmm. And you don't find any compromise in quality sending the music over the network like that?
No. I mean, it's amazing that it works at all. It depends. You know, if you have a modern Wi-Fi setup, you know, with a recent router, what is it running on 802.11n rather than the old
802.11n? Yeah.
Yeah, 802.11n. Then you won't have any problems. If you have an old Apple, you know, an old router from 5 years ago, which is, you know, on a more restricted bandwidth, you may have to, you may got dropouts. It depends completely on the construction of your house, you know, how your walls are, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. A related question is the age old question of tubes versus solid state electronics.
Yeah, this is, I mean, of course, back when I started getting into audio, it was all tubes. In fact, when I did my bachelor's degree, all the electronics I learned was tube electronics, constructing, you know, logic gates with tubes, and it was transistor was a new and wonderful device back in the mid 60s.
Right.
Gordon Holt again nailed it very early on in early issues of Stereophile, which was that. But what it came down to was the spectrum of the distortion that the amplifiers were producing. Tubes predominantly produce distortion, which is low order. It's, you know, distortion comprises harmonics. So if you play a tone of 1 kilohertz, if there's second harmonic distortion, there'll be a tone at 2 kilohertz. If there's third harmonic distortion, 3 kilohertz, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Now. Actually, funny, this goes back to what we were talking about intonation, because if it's second, it's an octave above the fundamental, it's completely musically natural tone. Same with the third harmonic, which is an octave and a half, octave and a fifth above the fundamental.
And a perfect fifth, yes.
It fits for music. It's not anything that's alien to the music. It won't be the same as the original, but it won't be doing anything which makes the music sound unmusical. Once you get to the seventh, the ninth, and the 11th harmonics, these are actually out of tune with equal temperament music.
Yep.
So now if you have an amplifier which is producing a lot of seventh harmonic, even at quite low levels, it's quite disturbing to hear because it's out of tune with the naturally occurring seventh harmonic in the music. So with the equal temperament seventh harmonic in the recorded music. The other thing is there's something called masking going on, which is the closer the distortion is to the fundamental, your human hearing will be less likely to hear it. The fundamental sort of dominates, gets a predominant share of your attention. The seventh harmonic is, you know, seven times the frequency. So there's a big gap between it and the fundamental. So it's not masked by the fundamental in anything like the same way the second is. So you have, in the early days of solid state, you had amplifiers which, even if they had relatively low levels of distortion compared with tube amps, were producing distortions which were unpleasant to listen to. So it became this, you know, the image of this typical solid state sound where it was hard and bright and fatiguing, whereas tube amps were warm and forgiving and lovely and friendly. Nowadays, you know, amplifier designers can make their amplifiers sound anything you like. You can get solid state amps which sound like tubes, and you can get tube amps which sound like solid state. Talented designers can tailor the sound of our amplifiers any way they want, no matter what the devices they use.
Certainly, with the advent of modern processors and so on, I've even seen examples of solid-state amps that are said to, quote, model the behavior of tubes.
Yes, in the musical instrument world, there's a lot of those you can buy where you can dial in sound of a classic Marshall head unit or a Fender Twin Reverb or a Vox AC30, whatever you want. And it's all done in DSP, digital signal processing.
Is that also done in consumer stereo equipment?
No. I don't think anyone's that cheeky.
That's getting pretty geeky, all right, I guess. But we're home theater geeks. Today we're audiophile geeks. Let me then ask you one last thing, and this is something I've written about recently and find fascinating. And that is the issue of what are sometimes called exotic or super expensive cables.
How long do we have?
Well, we may need to have you back and talk about this some more because this is a huge subject. I'd like to touch on it, though. I wrote recently... I did a profile, just sort of a product profile about, hey, look at, isn't this amazing? The Nordost Odin speaker cables, which cost $20,000 for a 1 meter pair of speaker cables.
Yeah.
and a lot of people responded to that blog and wrote things on both sides of the fence, you know. Oh, I've definitely heard the difference when I've substituted out, you know, expensive cables for cheapo cables. And others who were just as vehement saying, no way, it can't make any, it can't possibly make any difference.
I would love to be on that side of this argument, but there's no way they could make any difference.
But you're not on that side of the argument?
No, I mean, there are many cables which sound the same, but there are some cables which sound different. Some make, I mean, there are cables which make the sound worse.
Yeah.
So it's not expensive cables that make the sound worse. I'm not quite sure why people would buy those. I think that it's possible that if you hear a difference at all, you're so happy to hear a difference, you'll assume it's an improvement.
I've often thought that people who spend $20,000 on a 1 meter pair, they have to believe, they have to hear an improvement, because otherwise they can't justify that expense.
There are several things going on here. One is sociological. If you spend $250,000 on a system, are you going to cheap out and spend less than $20,000 on cables? there is that factor going on that, in a sense, expensive cables are aimed at people who buy expensive systems. Then it's up to the manufacturer to try to make sure that those are really good cables. The Nordost Odin, I did equivalent of a vertical wine tasting a couple of years back. And we set up a system and we listened to first an inexpensive Nordost cable, both for interconnects and speaker cables. Then we changed to a mid-priced Nordost cable and it sounded a bit better. And I mean, we're talking cables which are not that expensive, you know, maybe $1,000 for all the cables we were in use. Mm-hmm. And then we went to what had previously been the top Nordost, the Valhalla, which I thought it was stupid expensive at that time. And oh my goodness, that system sounded so good, you just wanted to cry. I mean, oh my, you know, then you find out what it costs and you go, well, you know, well, I'll pretend I didn't hear that. And then, and then we put in the Nordost Odin. And I mean, as good as we thought the sound had been with the Valhalla, the Odin just was even more wonderful. It was as though, I mean, this horrible cliche, veils drop, but they dropped, they did. Mm. And so forgetting the price, yes, that's quite an amazing cable.
This was not what we call a double blind test. You knew what you were listening to before you started in each case, right?
Yes. But then we went back to the cheap cable and, you know, and yes, it was pretty good and it wasn't the same. You know, you said earlier about people sort of, they have to believe that an expensive cable is good. And
better.
I would like to feel that, you know, an old codger like me who's heard it all and been everywhere and done it all, I'm not going to hear what I want to hear. I'm going to hear what's actually going on.
Mm.
And you know, there are many products which don't sound different and don't sound better. And my standard advice to people with respect to cables is try the cheapest cables. And if you like what you hear, you know, don't worry, be happy. And I mean, a lot of dealers will let you borrow cables. And if you borrow them and you borrow more expensive cables and you don't hear any difference, fine. You've lost nothing and you still have a good sounding system. There are a lot of technical reasons why cables make a difference. I find the people who endlessly talk on the bulletin boards on the internet about why there should be no differences really don't really understand the electronic theory that's going on.
Well, there isn't that much going on in a cable other than resistance or impedance, capacitance and inductance, right?
Yeah. And some of those cables which sound wrong have they unbalance that mixture. They have much higher inductance than is optimal for the amplifier, or they have much higher capacitance than the amplifier would like to see. So you're actually causing the amplifier to misbehave just through by modifying the load that it sees. I mean, I wrote an essay in the magazine. It was in 1995. You can find it on our website. But I came up with, I think, five mechanisms about why cables can affect the sound of a system. And it's primarily, it's because an amplifier, everyone thinks of, has one input, right? That's where you feed the signal from your preamp or your CD player. And it has one output, the loudspeaker. Amplifiers all have three sets of inputs. They have the one where you feed the signal. They have the power supply, which feeds the output transistors. That's also an input, because anything you do to the power supply will result in a change in the signal fed to the speakers. And the speaker terminals are also an input. And that sounds paradoxical. How can that be? Well, it's because all amplifiers use negative feedback to work, to operate with low distortion. And what negative feedback does is you take an amplifier which has much more gain than you need. You take a little bit of the output, turn it upside down. In other words, you swap positive for negative polarity, and you feed it back to the input. And what that does is reduce the gain to the level you want. And at the same time it does it, it reduces all the distortions to sometimes vanishingly low levels. This was all done by an AT&T, a Bell Labs researcher in the late 30s. He did all the theory of this. However, you've now got an input, which is another input to the amplifier, which is at the loudspeaker terminals. Anything you feed in to the loudspeaker terminals will go around the feedback loop and back into the main input of the amp and now be amplified. Well, what can go into loudspeaker terminals? Back EMF from the loudspeakers exists. It's sourced from very low impedance, and it's feeding a very low impedance. So in theory, it shouldn't have much an effect, but it might do. And the impedance is where they're no longer low is at radio frequencies. An amplifier may have an output impedance of 0.05 of an ohm in the audio band, might have an output impedance of 500 ohms in the RF band. And your loudspeaker may have an impedance of 8 ohms in the audio band, but it might have an impedance of, again, 100 ohms in the RF band. And the wires you have between the amplifier and the loudspeaker are an antenna. So now you have an antenna fed by a relatively high impedance, feeding an even higher impedance, and in an RF-rich environment. And when we all live in a soup of 2.4 gigahertz radiation
and 5 gigahertz
Wi-Fi, Wi-Fi, 5 gig from our remote phones we have in our homes. So now we live in this soup of radio frequency interference. We're putting an antenna on the output of our amplifier. The impedances are no longer low enough not to matter. And you are feeding that, you could be feeding that modulating RF energy into the negative feedback loop, into the beginning of the amplifier. And it's at those frequencies, the amplifier is no longer linear. It's going to produce large amounts of distortion, and it's going to produce, and there'll be hash and noise and demodulated crap dumped back into the audio band. And I think a lot of the differences people hear between amplifiers are due to that kind of mechanism. It's not due to, you know, frequency response changes. It's due to how well are you shielding the amplifier from the RF soup in which we all live. And some cables are very much better than others. And some cables will not act as antenna.
Right, because they're better shielded or they're better designed.
They have a weave which cancels out, you know, which the RF is going to be picked up as common mode, i.e. it affects both positive and negative conductors. With some weaves, they're very good at eliminating common mode noise pickup. So there's mechanisms like that going on which will affect sound quality. The problem is they're not predictable, because the RF soup I live in my house is not going to be the same as the RF soup in your house.
Yes.
So what might be a good cable in my system might not make any difference at all in your system.
Which is another argument for trying to find a retailer, if you're shopping for cables, who will let you borrow some cables.
Well, yes. I mean, the cable company, there's a mail order company called The Cable Company, will allow you to try before you buy. And I think all legitimate, you know, bricks and mortar retailers should do the same.
Mm. I've always maintained that the differences between cables would be more apparent in a very high-end, high-performance system than they would be in a mid-range or mediocre system. But what you're saying might dispute that.
I had a very instructive experience some years ago where I tried different cables with a boombox. And this was just the interconnect feeding a CD player to the aux input on the boombox. Mm-hmm. To my surprise, the cheap cables that came with a CD player sounded a lot worse than some relatively inexpensive cables from a specialty manufacturer. And I thought, well, goodness, what is going on there?
Mm.
So it may be that the boombox having a dreadfully unflat frequency response may be boosting frequencies in the treble, thus exaggerating any differences with the cable.
Mm-hmm. I was very disappointed when I started looking into this more carefully after my Odin article and getting so many responses. I learned of, or I was reminded, I should say, of James Randi's $1 million challenge.
Oh.
in which he says, anyone who can prove the existence of paranormal phenomena under strictly controlled conditions acceptable to both parties, hit Randi, James Randi, and the person claiming to have paranormal abilities, would win $1 million. And he included exotic cables in with this paranormal challenge. Now, the interesting thing was that a company called Pear Cable, which I'm sure you're familiar with, rose to the challenge and recruited Michael Fremer, a colleague of both of ours, as the listener to come in and do this blind A-B test. Well, Pear backed out, claiming that Randy's testing criteria were bogus and he was a charlatan and blah, blah, blah. So the test never happened. I was very disappointed in that because I really want a definitive, double-blind, test to see what kind of difference is audible.
Well, that's an interesting story. And if you read all the stuff on the internet about it, most of it's wrong. I mean, being involved with from Michael's side of it, what happened was our Pear cables backed out, and that's up to them. One's putting a gun to their head. But
I thought it was a mistake on their part.
I did too. Michael contacted Randi and said he was prepared to go ahead, but he would make one condition that he choose who ran the test. And Michael has some colleagues at Scientific American magazine who would be interested in organizing the test, proctoring it, mm-hmm. and also analyzing the results. And basically, Michael wanted to go ahead with it on those terms because he said if there's something going on, that'd be really fun, you know? And if I can't hear a difference, I can write about that. And if I can hear a difference, I can write about that too.
Yes.
So it all fell down. I mean, as far as I know, Michael's offer to Randi is still open, but Randi backed away. And it comes down to what you were saying. It had the difference between the cables had to be detected by paranormal means. And Michael said, I don't believe in paranormal means. There's something going on here. It's real. If it's real, you'll probably be able to eventually measure it, whatever the mechanism is. And Randi was, no, it has to be paranormal means. And Michael was saying, well, why? And the million dollar challenge is predicated on there being paranormal means. If Michael took the test, and as I said, he was prepared for third party monitoring from some respected scientists.
Right, Scientific American, you can't,
However, Randi, you said, okay, we'll go ahead with it, but I still won't have to pay out $1 million because you won't have detected the difference through paranormal means. So that, I think, is where the whole thing.
Oh, if that's the case, then I have to agree with Michael and disagree with Randi, because regardless of whether it's paranormal or not, the challenge is, can someone reliably distinguish, expensive cables from less expensive cables, regardless of test, the means.
Yeah, I think it was a test that you knew about at the CES 2 years ago. Where,
yes, that was the next one I was going to bring up,
Washington Post reporter just set up a system, and he
Wall
didn't
Street,
tell
Wall
people,
Street Journal, actually.
Wall Street Journal. He didn't tell people what the difference was. He just set up a system. He changed something and you had to write whether you heard a difference or not. It wasn't that scientifically rigorous, but nevertheless, no. He was bypassing anybody's expectations because he wasn't telling them it was a cable test. And Michael and I both took part in listeners, and Michael and I independently on our own came up with exactly the same result. Mm-hmm. But, you know, A was like this, B was like that. And then after the test was over, you know, the reporter revealed that the only difference was the cables he was using. So That was a neat test. It was, it wasn't scientifically rigorous, but nevertheless, it suggested that there was a real effect which people, if they weren't told what to hear for, nevertheless would still hear it.
It also brought up the interesting notion of the trained listener. I read the article by Lee Gomez, was the author, the reporter who conducted that test, and he did it with, I think, 39 or 40 people over the course of the show. You and Michael were two of them. And statistically, he got a result of something like 60%. Of the people who came through were able to make this were able to distinguish between the cables, as you and Michael were able to do. And that's not a lot better than chance. It's a little better than chance. It's a lot better than chance. Okay.
Yeah.
But
enough better than chance, because you're talking about these are still small differences. They're not going to be evident on all kinds of music all the time. So they're going to be relatively subtle. It's kind of sounds like distinguishing between two Chardonnays as opposed to a Chardonnay versus a Sauvignon Blanc. You know, there's not a gross difference, but there is a difference.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But it pointed out the importance of trained listeners.
Well, I think a lot of what makes someone an audiophile is having a mentor. Someone who can point out the difference. I took part in many, many blind listening tests in the 1980s with Martin Collins, an English engineer. And Martin basically educated me on sound. He'd say, you hear that? You hear that? That's the sound of a cone going into breakup around 2 kilohertz. Oh, I can hear that. And then from then on, you hear it every time it happens, which you then have to learn to hear through if you want to keep listening, enjoying your music.
Yeah, the same thing happens with video, too. You know, you point out DLP rainbows, for example, and all of a sudden you can't get away. You can't not see them.
Exactly. There's a very nice essay in the new issue of English magazine Audio Critic where Stan Curtis, amplifier designer, talks about looking at LCD panels. He was in the Malaysian factory making them for Dell, and they were rejecting panels as for having defective pixels that he couldn't see anything wrong with. And one of the girls on the production side said, no, look at the panel, kind of go into a trance, and the defective pixels will jump out at you. And he said, from then on, he saw defective pixels everywhere. it's mentoring, and it's as true in audiophiledom as it is in musical instrumentdom. Mm-hmm. You know,
or videophiledom.
Videophiledom, you know. Yeah, I mean, how many people are aware of motion artifacts when we're watching grossly compressed satellite TV, you know, where somebody's beard follows on later as they move across the screen? I'm astonished that they get away with a degree of compression on some of the standard definition satellite feeds.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, listen, John, this has been a great conversation. I really appreciate your time today, and I'm sure all the listeners are going to want to hear more, so I will have you back on the show. In the meantime, I want everyone to go check out Stereophile website at stereophile.com. Plenty of great information there. My online homes are ultimateavmag.com and hometheatermag.com, two more websites published by the same fine company. And you can email me with questions or suggestions for future podcast guests at scott@twit.tv. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be Joel Silver, president of the Imaging Science Foundation. And I know he's going to have a lot of very strong opinions about video, so please tune in for that. Until then, geek out!